station without delaying the rest of the crew. He looked at her suspiciously.
You, Doctor? Why should I come with you? You weren't even in there. You haven't seen enough to know anything.
Wilson moved over in front of Wakefield.
You were there, Richard, he said. You saw that place. You know what kind of intelligence and power it would take to make a space vehicle that large and then launch it on a trip between the stars. Hey, man, we're nothing to them. We're less than ants. We haven't got a chance.
I agree with you, Reggie, Richard Wakefield said calmly after a moment's hesitation. At least where our comparative capabilities are concerned. But we have no evidence they're hostile, or even care about whether or not we explore their craft. On the contrary, the very fact that we are alive...
Look! Shouted Irina Turgenev suddenly. Look at the monitor!
A solitary image was frozen on the giant screen in the control center. A crab-like creature filled the entire frame. It had a low, flat body, about twice as long as it was wide. Its weight was supported on 6 triple-jointed legs. 2 scissor-like claws extended in front of the body, and a whole row of manipulators, which looked uncannily like tiny human hands at first glance, nestled close to some kind of opening in the carapace. On closer inspection, the manipulators were a veritable hardware store of capabilities. There were pincers, probes, rasps, and even something that resembled a drill. Its eyes, if that's indeed what they were deeply recessed in protective hoods and raised like periscopes above the top of the shell. The eyeballs themselves were crystal or jelly, vivid blue in color, and utterly expressionless. From the legend on the side of the image, it was clear that the photograph had been taken just moments before by one of the long-range drones, at a spot roughly 5 kilometers south of the cylindrical sea. The frame, filmed with a telescopic lens, covered an area roughly 6 meters square.
So, we have company in Rama, said Janos Tiburi.
The rest of the cosmonauts stared at the monitor in amazement. All the crew later agreed that the image of the crab biot on the giant screen would not have been so frightening if it had not occurred at that precise moment. Although Reggie's behavior was definitely aberrant, there was enough sense in what he was saying to remind each of them of the dangers in their expedition. None of the crew was completely free from fear. All of them had, in some private moment, confronted the disquieting fact that the super-advanced Ramans might not be friendly. But most of the time they pushed aside their fears. It was part of their job. Like the early space shuttle astronauts in America, who knew that every so often the vehicle would crash or explode, the Newton cosmonauts accepted that there were uncontrollable risks associated with their mission. Healthy denial caused the group to avoid discussion of the unsettling issues most of the time, and to focus on the more bounded and therefore more controllable items, such as the sequence of events for the following day. Reggie's outburst and the simultaneous appearance of the crab biot on the monitor triggered one of the few philosophical group discussions that ever occurred on the project. O'Toole staked out his position early. Although he was fascinated by the Ramans, he did not fear them. God had seen fit to place him on this mission and, if he so chose, could decide that this extraordinary adventure would be O'Toole's last. In any case, whatever happened would be God's will. Richard Wakefield articulated a point of view that was apparently shared by several of the other crew members. To him, the entire project was both a challenging voyage of discovery and a test of personal mettle. The uncertainties were there, to be sure, but they produced excitement as well as danger. The intense thrill of new learning, together with the possible monumental significance of this extraterrestrial encounter, more than compensated for the risks. Richard had no qualms about the mission. He was certain that this was the apotheosis of his life. If he didn't live beyond the end of the project, it would still have been worth it. He would have done something important during his brief existence on Earth. Nicole listened attentively to the discussion. She didn't say much herself, but she found her own opinions crystallizing as she followed the flow of the conversation. She enjoyed watching the responses, both verbal and nonverbal, from the other cosmonauts. Shigeru Takagishi was clearly in the Wakefield camp. He was vigorously nodding his head the entire time Richard was talking about the excitement of participating in such a significant effort. Reggie Wilson, now subdued and probably embarrassed by his earlier tirade, did not say much. He commented only when asked a direct question. Admiral Heilmann looked uncomfortable from the beginning to the end. His entire contribution was to remind everyone of the passage of time. Surprisingly, Dr. David Brown did not add much to the philosophical discussion. He made several short comments, and once or twice seemed on the verge of launching into a long, amplifying explanation. But he never did. His true beliefs about the nature of Rama were not revealed. Francesca Sabatini initially acted as a kind of moderator, or interlocutor, asking questions of clarification and keeping the conversation on an even keel. Toward the end of the discussion, however, she offered several personal, candid comments of her own. Her philosophical view of the Newton mission was altogether different from that expressed by O'Toole and Wakefield.
"I think you're making this entire thing much too complex and intellectual,"
she said after Richard had delivered a long panegyric on the joys of knowledge.
"There was no need for me to do any deep soul-searching before I applied to be a Newton cosmonaut. I approach the issue the same way I do all my major decisions. I did a risk-reward trade-off. I judged that the rewards, considering all the factors, including fame, prestige, money, even adventure, more than warranted the risks. And I absolutely disagree with Richard in one respect. If I die on this mission, I will not be at all happy. For me, most of the rewards from this project are delayed. I cannot benefit from them if I do not return to Earth."
Francesca's comments aroused Nicole's curiosity. She wanted to ask the Italian journalist some more questions, but Nicole didn't think it was the proper time or place. After the meeting was over, she was still intrigued by what Francesca had said. "Can life really be that simple to her?" Nicole thought to herself. "Can everything be evaluated in terms of risks and rewards?" She remembered Francesca's lack of emotion when she drank the abortion liquid. But what about principles, or values, or even feelings? As the meeting broke up, Nicole admitted to herself that Francesca was still very much a puzzle. Nicole watched Dr. Takagishi carefully. He was handling himself much better today.
"I have brought a printout of the sortie strategy, Dr. Brown," he was saying, waving a 4-inch thick set of papers in his hand. "To remind us of the fundamental tenets of sortie design that resulted from over a year of unhurried mission planning. May I read from the summary?"
"I don't think you need to do that," David Brown responded. "We're all familiar with—"
"I'm not," interrupted General O'Toole. "I would like to hear it.
Admiral Heilmann asked me to pay close attention and brief him on the issues." Dr. Brown waved for Takagishi to continue. The diminutive Japanese scientist was borrowing a page from Brown's own portfolio. Even though he knew that David Brown personally favored going after the crab biots on the second sortie, Takagishi still was attempting to convince the other cosmonauts that the top priority activity should be a scientific foray into the city of New York. Reggie Wilson had excused himself an hour earlier and had gone to his room for a nap. The remaining 5 crew members on board the Newton had spent most of the afternoon struggling, without success, to reach an agreement on the activities for the second sortie. Since the 2 scientists, Brown and Takagishi, had radically different opinions on what should be done, no consensus was possible. Meanwhile, behind them on the large monitor, there had been intermittent views of the space cadets and Admiral Heilmann working inside Rama. The current picture showed Taburi and Turgenev at the campsite adjoining the cylindrical sea. They had just finished assembling the second motorboat and were checking its electrical subsystems.
"The sequence of sorties has been carefully designed," Takagishi was reading, "to be consistent with the Mission Policies and Priorities Document, ISA NT-0014. The primary goals of the first sortie are to establish the engineering infrastructure and to examine the interior on at least a superficial level. Of particular importance will be the identification of any characteristics of this second Rama spacecraft that are in any way different from the first. Sortie number 2 is designed to complete the mapping of the inside of Rama, focusing particularly on regions unexplored 70 years ago, as well as the collections of buildings called cities and any interior differences identified on the first sortie. Encounters with biots will be avoided on the second sortie, although the presence and location of the various kinds of biots will be part of the mapping process. Interaction with the biots will be delayed until the third sortie. Only after careful and prolonged observation will any attempt be made."
"That's enough, Dr. Takagishi," David Brown interrupted. "We all have the gist of it. Unfortunately, that sterile document was prepared months before launch. The situation we face now was never contemplated. We have the lights going on and off, and we have located and are tracking a herd of 6 crab biots just beyond the southern edge of the cylindrical sea.
I disagree, said the Japanese scientist respectfully. You said yourself that the unpredicted lighting profile did not represent a fundamental difference between the 2 spacecraft. We are not facing an unknown, Rama. I submit that we should implement the sorties in accordance with the original mission plan.
So, you favor dedicating this entire second sortie to mapping, including or perhaps even featuring a detailed exploration of New York? Asked O'Toole.
Exactly, General O'Toole. Even if one takes the position that the strange sound heard by cosmonauts Wakefield, Sabatini, and myself does not constitute an official difference, the careful mapping of New York is clearly one of the highest priority activities, and it is vital that we accomplish it on this sortie. The temperature in the central plane has already risen to -5 degrees. Rama is carrying us closer and closer to the sun. The spacecraft is heating from the outside in. I predict the cylindrical sea will begin to melt from the bottom in 3 or 4 more days.
I have never said that New York was not a legitimate target for exploration, David Brown interrupted again. But I have maintained from the very beginning that the biots are the true scientific treasure of this voyage. Look at these amazing creatures, he said, filling the center screen with a film of the 6 crab biots moving slowly across a bland region in the southern hemisphere. We may never have another opportunity to capture one. The drones have almost finished reconnoitering the entire interior, and no other biots have been spotted. The rest of the crew members, including Takagishi, looked at the monitor with rapt attention. The bizarre assemblage of aliens, arranged in a triangular formation with a slightly larger specimen in the lead, approached a jumbled mound of loose metal. The lead crab moved directly into the obstacle, paused a few seconds, and then used its claws to chop the elements of the mound into still smaller pieces. The 2 crabs in the second row transferred the metal fragments onto the backs of the remaining 3 members of the troop. This new material increased the size of the small piles already on the tops of the shells of the 3 crab biots in the back row.
They must be the Raman garbage crew, Francesca said.
Everyone laughed.
But you can see why I want to move quickly, David Brown continued. Right now, the short film we just saw is on its way to all the television networks on Earth. Over 1 billion of our fellow men and women will watch it today, with the same mixture of fear and fascination that all of you just felt. Imagine what kind of laboratories we will be able to build to study such a creature. Imagine what we will learn.
What makes you think we can capture one? General O'Toole asked. They look as if they could be quite formidable.
We are certain that these creatures, although they appear to be biological, are actually robots. Hence the name Biots, which became popular during and after the first Rama expedition. Based on all the reports from Norton and the other Rama 1 cosmonauts, each of these biots is designed to perform a singular function. They have no intelligence as we know it. We should be able to outsmart them and capture them.
A camera close-up of the scissor-like claws appeared on the giant screen. They were obviously very sharp.
I don't know, said General O'Toole. I'd be inclined to follow Dr. Takagishi's suggestion and observe him for quite a while before trying to catch one.
I disagree, said Francesca. Speaking as a journalist, no story could be bigger than the attempted capture of one of those things. Everyone on Earth will watch. We may never have another chance like this.
She paused for a moment.
The ISA has been pushing us for some upbeat news. The Bortsov incident didn't exactly convince the taxpayers of the world that their space money is being wisely spent.
Why can't we do both tests on the same sortie? General O'Toole asked. One sub-team could explore New York and the other would go after a crab.
No way, replied Nicole. If the goal of this sortie is to seize a biot, then all of our resources should be applied in that direction. Remember, we are limited in both manpower and time.
Unfortunately, David Brown now said with a wan smile, we can't make this decision by committee. Since we don't have complete agreement, I must make the choice. Therefore, the purpose of the next sortie will be to capture a crab biot. I presume that Admiral Heilman will agree with me. If he doesn't, we will submit the issue to a vote of the crew. The meeting broke up slowly. Dr. Takagishi wanted to offer one more argument, to point out that the majority of the biot species seen by the first Rama explorers did not materialize until after the thawing of the cylindrical sea.
but nobody wanted to listen anymore. Everyone was tired. Nicole approached Takagishi and clandestinely activated her biometry scanner. The warning file was empty.
"Clean as a whistle," she said with a smile.
Takagishi looked at her very seriously.
"Our decision is a mistake," he said somberly. "We should be going into New York."
Chapter 27 To Catch a Biot.
"Be very careful,"
Admiral Heilmann said to Francesca.
"It makes me nervous to see you leaning out like that."
Signora Sabatini had hooked her ankles underneath the seats of the helicopter and was now stretching out beyond the plane of the door. She was holding a small video camera in her right hand. 3 or 4 meters below her, apparently oblivious to the whirring machine overhead, the 6 crab biots plodded methodically along. They were still in their phalanx formation, arranged like the first 3 rows of a set of bowling pins.
"Move out over the sea,"
Francesca shouted to Hiro Yamanaka.
"They're coming to the edge, and we'll be turning again."
The helicopter veered sharply to the left and flew over the side of the 500-meter cliff that separated the southern half of Rama from the cylindrical sea. The bank here was 10 times higher above the water than its northern counterpart. David Brown gasped as he looked down at the frozen sea 0.5 kilometer below him.
"This is ridiculous, Francesca," he said. "What do you hope to accomplish? The automatic camera in the nose of the copter will take adequate pictures."
"This camera was specifically designed for zoom action," she said. "Besides, a little jitter gives the images more verisimilitude."
Yamanaka steered back toward the bank. The biots were now about 30 meters directly ahead. The lead biot came up to within 0.5 body length of the edge, paused for a fraction of a second, and then turned abruptly to its right. Another quick 90-degree right turn completed the maneuver and left the biot heading in the exact opposite direction. The other 5 crabs followed their leader, executing their turns row by row with military precision.
"I got it that time,"
Francesca said happily, pulling herself back into the helicopter.
"Head on and full frame. And I think I caught a glimmer of movement in the leader's blue eye just before it turned."
The biots were now ambling away from the cliff at their normal speed of 10 kilometers per hour. Their movement caused a slight indentation in the loamy soil. Their heading was along a path parallel to their last previous sweep toward the sea. From above, the whole region looked like a suburban yard in which part of the grass had been mowed. On one side the ground was neat and packed, while in the territory not yet covered by the biots, there was no orderly pattern in the soil markings.
"This could get boring,"
Francesca said, playfully reaching up and putting her arms around David Brown's neck.
"We may have to amuse ourselves with something else."
"We'll only watch them one more strip. Their pattern is fairly simple." He ignored Francesca's light tickling on his neck. It seemed as if he were going through some kind of checklist in his mind.
At length, Brown spoke into the communicator.
"What do you think, Dr. Takagishi? Is there anything else we should do at this time?"
Back in the scientific control center on the Newton, Dr. Takagishi was following the progression of the biots on the monitor.
"It would be extremely valuable," he said, "if we could find out more about their sensory capabilities before we try to capture one of them. So far, they have not responded to noises or to distant visual stimuli. In fact, they have apparently not even noticed our presence. As I'm sure you would agree, we don't have enough data yet to come to any definitive conclusions. If we could expose them to an entire range of electromagnetic frequencies and calibrate their responses, then we might have a better idea."
"But that would take days,"
Dr. Brown interrupted. "And in the final analysis, we would still have to take our chances. I can't imagine what we might learn that would materially alter our plans."
"If we found out more about them first,"
Takagishi argued,
"then we could design a better, safer capture procedure. It might even occur that we would learn something that would dissuade us altogether."
"Unlikely," was David Brown's abrupt response. As far as he was concerned, this particular discussion was over.
"Hey there, Tabori," he now shouted. "How are you guys coming with the huts?"
"We're almost finished,"
the Hungarian answered.
"Another 30 minutes at the most. Then I'll be ready for a nap."
"Lunch comes first,"
Francesca interjected.
"You can't go to sleep on an empty stomach."
"What are you cooking, beautiful?"
Tabori bantered.
"Ossobuco alla rama."
"That's enough,"
Dr. Brown said. He paused for a couple of seconds.
"O'Toole," he then continued, "can you handle the Newton all by yourself, at least for the next 12 hours?
"Affirmative," was the response.
Then send down the rest of the crew. By the time we all meet at the new campsite, it should be ready for occupancy. We'll have some lunch and a brief nap. Then we'll plan our buyout hunt.
Below the helicopter, the six crab-like creatures continued their relentless march across the barren soil. The four human beings watched them encounter a distinct boundary, where the floor changed from dirt and small rocks into a fine wire mesh. As soon as they touched the narrow lane dividing the two sections, the biots executed a U-turn. They then headed back toward the sea along a parallel line adjacent to their last track. Yamanaka banked the helicopter, increased his altitude, and headed for the Beta campsite 10 kilometers across the cylindrical sea. They were all correct, Nicole was thinking. Seeing it on the monitor is nothing by comparison. She was descending on the chairlift into Rama. Now that she was beyond the halfway point, she had a breathtaking view in every direction. She remembered a similar feeling once, when she had been standing on the Tonto Plateau, in the Grand Canyon National Park. But that was made by nature and took over 1 billion years, she said to herself. Rama was actually built by somebody, or something. The chair momentarily slowed. Shigeru Takagishi climbed off 1 kilometer below her. Nicole couldn't see him, but she could hear him talking to Richard Wakefield on the communicator.
"Hurry up," she heard Reggie Wilson shout. "I don't like sitting here in the middle of nowhere."
Nicole enjoyed being suspended on the chairlift. The amazing scene around her was temporarily almost static, and she could study at her leisure any feature that was particularly interesting. After one more stop for Wilson to disembark, Nicole was at last approaching the bottom of the Alpha chairlift herself. She watched, fascinated, as the resolution of her eyes improved quickly during the last 300 meters of her descent. What had been a jumble of indistinct images resolved itself into a rover, 3 people, some equipment, and a small surrounding camp. After a few more seconds, she could identify each of the 3 men. She had a quick flashback to another chairlift ride, this one in Switzerland some 2 months before. An image of King Henry flitted momentarily through her mind. It was replaced by the smiling face of Richard Wakefield just below her. He was giving her instructions on how best to ease herself out of the chair. "It will never come to a complete stop," he was saying, "but it will slow down a lot. Unfasten your belt, and then hit the ground walking, as if you were coming off a moving walkway." He grabbed her by the waist and lifted her off the platform. Takagishi and Wilson were already in the back seat of the rover. "Welcome to Rama," Wakefield said. "All right, Tabori," he then spoke into the communicator. "We're all here and ready to go. We're switching now to the listen-only mode for our drive."
"Hurry," Janos urged him. "We're having a hard time not eating your lunch. By the way, Richard, will you bring Toolbox C when you come? We've been talking about nets and cages, and I may need a wider variety of gadgets."
"Roger," Wakefield replied.
He jogged over to the campsite and entered the only large hut. He emerged with a long rectangular metal box that was obviously very heavy.
"Shit, Tabori," he said into the radio. "What in the world is in here?"
They all heard a laugh.
"Everything you could possibly need to catch a crab biot, and then some."
Wakefield switched off the transmitter and climbed in the rover. He started driving away from the stairway in the direction of the cylindrical sea.
"This biot hunt is the stupidest goddamn idea I've ever heard," Reggie Wilson groused. "Somebody is going to get hurt."
There was quiet in the rover for almost 1 minute. To the right, at the limit of their vision, the cosmonauts could barely see the Raman city of London.
"Well, how does it feel to be part of the second team?" Wilson said to nobody in particular.
After an awkward silence, Dr. Takagishi turned to address him.
"Excuse me, Mr. Wilson," he said politely. "Are you talking to me?"
"Sure I am," Wilson replied,
nodding his head up and down.
"Didn't anyone ever tell you you were the number 2 scientist on this mission?"
"I guess not," Wilson continued after a short pause.
"But that's not surprising. Down on Earth, I never knew that I was the number 2 journalist."
"Reggie, I don't think—"
Nicole said before she was interrupted.
"As for you, Doctor,"
Wilson leaned forward in the rover,
"you may be the only member of the third team. I overheard our glorious leaders Heilman and Brown talking about you. They'd like to leave you on the Newton permanently. But since we may need your skills—"
"That's enough," Richard Wakefield broke in. There was a threatening edge in his voice. "You can stop being so unpleasant." Several tense seconds passed before Wakefield spoke again.
By the way, Wilson, he said in a friendlier tone, if I remember correctly, you're a racing fanatic. Would you like to drive this buggy? It was the perfect suggestion. A few minutes later, Reggie Wilson was in the driver's seat beside Wakefield, laughing wildly as he accelerated the Rover around a tight circle. Cosmonauts Desjardins and Takagishi were bumping around in the back seat. Nicole was observing Wilson very carefully. He's erratic again, she was thinking. That's at least 3 times in the last 2 days. Nicole tried to recall when she had last done a full scan on Wilson. Not since the day after Bortsov died. I've checked the cadets 2 times in the interim. Damn it, she said to herself. I let my preoccupation with the Bortsov incident make me careless. She made a mental note to scan everyone as soon as possible after she arrived at the Beta campsite. Say, my good professor, Richard Wakefield said once Wilson had finally straightened out and was heading for camp. I have a question for you. He turned around and faced the Japanese scientist. Have you figured out our strange sound from the other day? Or has Dr. Brown convinced you that it was just a figment of our collective imagination? Dr. Takagishi shook his head. I told you at the time that it was a new noise. He stared off in the distance, across the unexplained mechanical fields of the central plain. This is a different Rama. I know it. The checkerboard squares in the south are laid out in an entirely new pattern, and no longer extend to the shore of the cylindrical sea. The lights now go on before the sea melts, and they go off abruptly, without dimming for several hours, as the first Rama explorers reported. The crab biots now appear in herds instead of individually. He paused, still looking out across the fields. Dr. Brown says that all these differences are trivial, but I think they mean something. It's just possible, Takagishi said softly, that Dr. Brown is wrong. It's also possible that he's a complete son of a bitch, said Wilson bitterly. He accelerated the rover to its maximum speed. Beta campsite, here we come.
Chapter 28 Extrapolation. Nicole completed her lunch of pressed duck, reconstituted broccoli, and mashed potatoes. The rest of the cosmonauts were still eating, and it was temporarily quiet at the long table. In the corner, by the entrance, a monitor tracked the location of the crab biots. Their pattern had not changed. The blip representing the crabs would move in one direction for slightly more than 10 minutes, and then reverse itself. What happens after they finish this parcel? Richard Wakefield asked. He was looking at a computer map of the area that was posted on a temporary bulletin board.
Last time they followed one of those lanes between the checkerboard partitions until they came to a hole,
Francesca responded from the other end of the table.
Then they dumped their garbage in it. They haven't picked up anything in this new territory, so what they will do when they finish is anybody's guess.
Everyone is convinced that our biots are in fact garbage men, Richard asked. The evidence is fairly strong, David Brown said. A similar solitary crab biot encountered by Jimmy Pack inside the first Rama was also believed to be a garbage collector.
We flatter ourselves,
Shigeru Takagishi said softly, after a long silence. He finished chewing his last bite and swallowed.
Dr. Brown himself was the one who first said that it was unlikely we human beings could comprehend what Rama was about. Our conversation reminds me of that old Hindu proverb about the blind men who felt the elephant. They all described it differently, for each of them touched only a small part of the animal. None of them was correct.
You don't think our crabs work for the Rama Sanitation Department? Janos inquired.
I didn't say that,
Takagishi replied.
I merely suggested that it's hubris on our part to conclude so quickly that those 6 creatures have no purpose except cleaning up the garbage. Our observational data is woefully inadequate.
Sometimes it is necessary to extrapolate, Dr. Brown rejoined testily, and even speculate based on minimal amounts of data. You know yourself that new science is based on maximum likelihood rather than certainty.
Before we become involved in an esoteric discussion about science and its methodology, Janos now interrupted with a grin, I have a spotting proposition for you all.
He stood up at his place.
Actually, it was Richard's idea originally, but I figured out how to make it into a game. It has to do with the lights.
Janos took a quick drink of water from his cup.
Since we first arrived here in Rama Land, he intoned formally, There have been 3 transitions in the Illumination State. Boo! Hiss! Shouted Wakefield. Janos laughed. Okay, you guys, the little Hungarian then continued in his normal, offhand way. What's the deal with the lights? They've come on, gone off, and now come on again. What's going to happen in the future? I propose that we have a pool and contribute, say, 20 marks apiece. Each of us will make a prediction about the behavior of the lights for the rest of the mission, and whoever is closest will win the pot.
Who will judge the winner?
Reggie Wilson inquired sleepily. He had yawned several times during the preceding hour.
Despite the impressive set of brains around this table, I don't think anyone has figured out Rama yet. My personal belief is that the lights will not follow any pattern. They will go on and off at random times to keep us guessing.
Write it down and send it on the modem to General O'Toole. Richard and I agreed that he would make a perfect judge. When the mission is over, he'll compare the predictions with actuality, and someone will win a lucky dinner for two.
Dr. David Brown pushed his chair back from the table. Are you finished with your game, Tabori? He asked.
If so, he added, without waiting for an answer, perhaps we can clean up this lunch mess and get on with our schedule.
Hey, Skipper, Janos replied. I'm just trying to loosen things up. Everybody's getting tense.
Brown walked out of the hut before Cosmonaut Tabori had finished his sentence.
What's bothering him?
Richard asked Francesca.
I guess he's anxious about the hunt, Francesca answered. He has been in a bad mood since this morning. Maybe he's feeling all the responsibility.
Maybe he's just a jerk, said Wilson. He too rose from his seat. I'm going to take a nap.
As Wilson was leaving the large hut, Nicole remembered that she wanted to check everyone's biometry before the hunt. It was a simple enough task. All she needed was to stand close to each cosmonaut for about 45 seconds with her activated scanner, and then read the critical data off the monitor. If there were no entries in the warning files, the entire procedure was quite straightforward. On this particular check, everyone was clean, including Takagishi.
Nice going, Nicole said to her Japanese colleague, very quietly.
She walked outside to look for David Brown and Reggie Wilson. Dr. Brown's hut was at the far end of the campsite. Like the rest of the individual dwellings, his hut resembled a tall, skinny hat sitting on the ground. All the huts were off-white in color, about 2.5 meters tall, with a circular base just under 2 meters in diameter. They were manufactured with super-lightweight, flexible materials that combined easy packing and storage with formidable strength. Nicole remarked to herself that the huts looked something like Native American Indian teepees. David Brown was in his hut, sitting cross-legged on the ground in front of a portable computer monitor. On the screen was text from the chapter on biots in Takagishi's Atlas of Rama.
"Excuse me, Dr. Brown?"
Nicole said, as she stuck her head in his door.
"Yes," he said. "What is it?"
He made no attempt to hide his annoyance at the interruption.
"I need to check your biometry data," Nicole said. "You haven't been dumped since right before the first sortie."
Brown gave her an irritated glance. Nicole held her ground. The American shrugged his shoulders, half grunted, and turned back to the monitor. Nicole knelt beside him and activated her scanner.
"There are some folding chairs over in the supply hut," Nicole offered as Dr. Brown shifted his weight uncomfortably on the ground.
He ignored her comment.
"Why is he so rude to me?"
Nicole found herself wondering.
"Is it because of that report on Wilson and him?"
No, she thought, answering her own question. "It's because I have never been properly deferential." Data began to appear on Nicole's screen. She carefully keyed in several inputs that permitted a synopsis of the warning data to be shown.
"Your blood pressure has been too high for intermittent intervals during the last 72 hours, including almost all of today," she said without emotion. "This particular kind of pattern is usually associated with stress."
Dr. Brown stopped reading about biots and turned to face his life science officer. He looked at the displayed data without understanding it.
"This graph shows the amplitudes and durations of your out-of-tolerance excursions," Nicole said, pointing at the screen. "None of the individual occurrences would be serious by itself, but the overall pattern is cause for concern."
"I have been under some pressure," he mumbled.
David Brown watched while Nicole called up other displays, showing data that corroborated her original statements. Many of Brown's warning files were overflowing. The lights continued to flash on the monitor.
"What's the worst-case scenario?" he inquired.
Nicole eyed her patient.
A stroke with paralysis or death, she replied.
If the condition persists or worsens. He whistled.
What should I do?
In the first place, Nicole answered, you must start by getting more sleep. Your metabolic profile shows that since the death of General Burtsov, you have only had a total of 11 hours of solid rest. Why didn't you tell me you were having trouble sleeping?
I thought it was just excitement. I even took a sleeping pill one night, and it had no effect.
Nicole's brow furrowed.
I don't remember giving you any sleeping pills.
Dr. Brown smiled.
Shit, he said. I forgot to tell you. I was talking to Francesca Sabatini about my insomnia one night, and she offered me a pill. I took it without thinking.
What night was that? Nicole asked.
She changed displays again on her monitor and called for more data from the storage buffers.
I'm not certain, Dr. Brown said, after some hesitation.
I think it was...
Oh, here it is, Nicole said.
I can see it in the chemical analysis.
That was March 3rd, the second night after Botsov's death, the day you and Heilman were selected as joint commanders. From the breakout in this spectrometry data, I would guess that you took a single Medvil.
You can tell that from my biometry data?
Not exactly, Nicole said with a smile.
The interpretation is not unique.
What was it you said at lunch? Sometimes it's necessary to extrapolate and speculate?
Their eyes met for a moment.
Could that be fear?
Nicole wondered as she tried to interpret what she was seeing in his gaze. Dr. Brown looked away.
Thank you, Dr. Desjardins, he said stiffly, for your report and my blood pressure. I will try to relax and get plenty of sleep. And I apologize for not informing you about the sleeping pill.
He dismissed her with a wave of his hand. Nicole started to protest her dismissal, but decided against it.
He wouldn't follow my advice anyway, she said to herself as she walked toward Wilson's hut.
And his blood pressure was certainly not dangerously high. She thought about the strained final 2 minutes of their conversation, after she had astonished Dr. Brown by correctly identifying the type of sleeping pill. There's something not quite right here. What is it that I am missing?
She could hear Reggie Wilson snoring before she arrived at the door of his tent. After a brief debate with herself, Nicole decided that she would scan him after his nap. She then returned to her own hut and quickly fell asleep.
Nicole? Nicole Desjardins?
The voice intruded in her dream and awakened her.
It's me, Francesca. I need to tell you something.
Nicole sat up slowly on her cot. Francesca had already entered the hut. The Italian was wearing her friendliest smile, the one that Nicole had thought was always saved for the camera.
I was talking to David just a few minutes ago, Francesca said as she approached the cot. And he told me about your conversation after lunch.
Francesca kept talking as Nicole yawned and swung her legs around to the floor.
I was, of course, very concerned to learn about his blood pressure. Don't worry, he and I have already agreed that I won't use it. But what really bothered me was he reminded me that we never told you about the sleeping pill. I'm so embarrassed. We should have told you immediately.
Francesca was talking too fast for Nicole. Just moments before, she had been in a deep sleep, dreaming of Beauvoir. And now, all of a sudden, she was expected to listen to a staccato confession from the Italian cosmonaut.
"Can you wait a minute until I wake up?"
Nicole asked crossly. She leaned around Francesca to a makeshift table and took a cup of water. She drank slowly.
"Now, I'm about to understand," Nicole said, "that you have awakened me to tell me that you gave Dr. Brown a sleeping pill. Something I already know?"
"Yes," Francesca said with a smile. "I mean, that's part of it. But I realized that I had forgotten to tell you about Reggie also."
Nicole shook her head.
"I'm not following you, Francesca. Are you talking about Reggie Wilson now?"
Francesca hesitated for a second.
"Yes," she said. "Didn't you check him with your scanner right after lunch?"
Nicole shook her head again.
"No, he was already asleep."
She looked at her watch.
"I had planned to scan him before the meeting started. Maybe an hour from now."
Francesca was flustered.
"Well," she said, "when David told me that the Medvil showed up in his biometry data, I thought..."
She stopped herself in mid-sentence. She seemed to be collecting her thoughts. Nicole waited patiently.
"Reggie started complaining of headaches over a week ago,"
Francesca eventually continued.
after the two Newton ships joined for the rendezvous with Rama. Since he and I have been close friends, and he knew about my knowledge of drugs, you know, from all that work on my documentary series, he asked me if I would give him something for headaches. I refused at first, but finally, after he kept badgering me, I gave him some Nubitrol.
Nicole frowned. That's a very strong medicine for a simple headache. There are still doctors who believe it should never be prescribed unless everything else has failed.
I told him all that, Francesca said. He was adamant. You don't know, Reggie. Sometimes you can't reason with him.
How much did you give him?
8 pills altogether, a total of 200 milligrams.
No wonder he's been acting so strangely.
Nicole leaned over and picked up her pocket computer, sitting on the end table. She accessed her medical database and read the short entry about Nubitrol.
Not much here, she said.
I'll have to ask O'Toole to transmit the full entry from the medical encyclopedia, but if I remember correctly, wasn't there a controversy about Nubitrol remaining in the system for weeks?
I don't recall, Francesca replied.
She looked at the monitor in Nicole's hand and quickly read the text. Nicole was irritated. She started to lambast Francesca verbally, but at the last moment changed her mind. So you gave drugs to both David and Reggie, she was thinking. Out of her memory came a vague recollection of Francesca handing Valery Botsov a glass of wine several hours before he died. A strange chill ran through Nicole's body. Could her intuition be correct? Nicole turned around and fixed Francesca with a cold stare.
Now that you have confessed to playing doctor and pharmacist for both David and Reggie, is there anything else you want to tell me?
What do you mean? Francesca asked.
Have you given drugs to any other member of the crew?
Nicole felt her heart race as Francesca blanched, ever so slightly, and hesitated before replying.
No, no, of course not,
was her answer. Chapter 29 The Hunt. The helicopter very slowly dropped the rover to the ground.
How much further?
Janos Taburi asked over the communicator.
About 10 meters, Richard Wakefield replied from below.
He was standing in a spot about 100 meters south of the edge of the cylindrical sea. Above him, the rover dangled at the end of 2 long cables.
Be careful to let it down gently. There are some delicate electronics in the chassis.
Hiro Yamanaka commanded the helicopter into its tightest possible altitude control loop, while Janos electronically extended the cables a few centimeters at a time.
Contact! Shouted Wakefield. On the rear wheels. The front needs to come down another meter.
Francesca Sabatini raced around to the side of the rover to record its historic touchdown in the southern hemicylinder of Rama. 50 meters further from the cliff, in the neighborhood of a hut that was serving as a temporary headquarters, the rest of the cosmonauts were preparing for the hunt to begin. Irina Turgenev was checking the installation of the cable snare in the second helicopter. David Brown was by himself a few meters away from the hut, talking on the radio with Admiral Heilman back at the Beta campsite. The two men were reviewing the details of the capture plan. Wilson, Takagishi, and Desjardins were watching the conclusion of the rover landing operation.
Now we know who's really the boss of this outfit, Reggie Wilson was saying to his two companions.
He pointed at Dr. Brown.
This damn hunt is more like a military operation than anything we've done. Yet our senior scientist is in charge, and our ranking officer is manning the phones.
He spat on the ground.
Christ! Do we have enough equipment here? 2 helicopters, a rover, 3 different kinds of cages, not to mention several large boxes of electrical and mechanical shit. Those poor bastard crabs don't have a chance.
Dr. Takagishi put the laser binoculars to his eyes. He found the target quickly. 0.5 kilometer to the east, the crab biots were nearing the edge of the cliff again. Nothing about their motion had changed.
We need all the equipment because of the uncertainty, Takagishi said quietly.
Nobody really knows what is going to happen.
I hope the lights go out, Wilson said with a laugh.
We're prepared for that, David Brown interjected tersely as he walked up to join the other 3 cosmonauts. The shells of the crabs have been sprayed with a light fluorescent material, and we have plenty of flares. While you were complaining about the length of our last meeting, we were finishing the contingency plans.
He stared truculently at his countrymen.
You know, Wilson, you could try...
Brick, brick!
The voice of Otto Heilman interrupted him.
News! Hot news!
I just received word from O'Toole that INN will be carrying our feed live, beginning 20 minutes from now.
Good work, replied Brown. We should be ready by then.
I see Wakefield heading this way in the rover, he glanced at his watch, and the crab should be turning again in another few seconds. Incidentally, Otto, do you still disagree with my suggestion to snare the lead biot?
Yes, David, I do. I think it's an unnecessary risk. What little we do know suggests that the lead crab has the most capability. Why take a chance? Any biot would be an incredible treasure to carry back to Earth, particularly if it's still functional. We can worry about the leader after we already have one in the bag.
Then I guess I'm outvoted on this one.
Dr. Takagishi and Taburi both agree with you. So does General O'Toole.
We'll proceed with Plan B. The target biot will be number 4, the back right biot, as we approach from the rear.
The rover, carrying Wakefield and Sabatini, arrived at the hut area at almost the same time as the helicopter.
Good job, men, Dr. Brown said, as Taburi and Yamanaka jumped down from the copter. Take a short breather, Yanas. Then go over and make sure Tugeniev and the cable snare are both ready to go. I want you airborne in 5 minutes.
All right, Brown said, turning to the others. This is it. Wilson, Takagishi, and Desjardins in the rover with Wakefield. Francesca, you come with me in the second helicopter with Hero.
Nicole started walking toward the rover, but Francesca intercepted her.
Have you ever used one of these?
The Italian journalist extended a video camera the size of a small book.
Once, Nicole answered, studying the camera in Francesca's hand. 11 or 12 years ago, I recorded one of Dr. Delon's brain operations. I guess...
Look, interrupted Francesca. I could use some help. I'm sorry I didn't discuss it with you earlier, but I didn't know. Anyway, I need another camera, one on the ground, especially now that we're live on INN. I'm not asking for miracles. You're the only one who...
What about Reggie? Nicole replied.
He's the other journalist.
Reggie won't help, Francesca said quickly. Dr. Brown called for her to come to the helicopter.
Will you do it, Nicole? Please? Or should I ask someone else?
Why not? Ran through Nicole's mind. I have nothing else to do, unless an emergency comes up.
Sure,
she replied.
Thanks a million,
Francesca shouted as she handed Nicole the camera and dashed off to the waiting helicopter.
Well, well, said Reggie Wilson, as Nicole approached the rover with the camera cradled in her hands. I see that our crew doctor has been recruited by the number one journalist. I hope you ask for the minimum wage.
Lighten up, Reggie, Nicole replied.
It doesn't bother me to help others when I have nothing specific to do myself.
Wakefield switched on the rover and began to drive east towards the biots. The headquarters had been intentionally established in the area already cleaned by the crabs. The packed soil made progress very easy for the rover. They were within 100 meters of the biots in less than 3 minutes. Overhead, the two helicopters circled around the crabs.
What exactly do you want me to do?
Nicole called to Francesca on the rover transmitter.
Try to move parallel to the biots, Francesca answered. You can probably run alongside, at least for some of the time. The most important moment is when Janos tries to close the snare.
We're all ready here, Taburi announced a few seconds later. Just give the word.
Are we on the air?
Brown asked Francesca. She nodded her head. He said to Janos,
Go ahead.
From out of one of the helicopters came a long, thick cable with what looked like an inverted basket on the end.
Janos will try to center the snare on the target biot, Wakefield explained to Nicole, and let the sides drape naturally over the corner of the shell. Then he will increase the tension and pull the biot off the ground. We will cage the crab after we return it to the beta campsite.
Let's see what they look like from down there, Nicole heard Francesca say.
The rover was now right next to the biots. Nicole climbed out and jogged beside them. She was frightened at first. For some reason, she had not expected them to be so large or so strange-looking. Their metallic sheen reminded her of the cold exterior of many of the new buildings in Paris. As she ran along on the soil, the biots were only about 2 meters away from her. With the automatic focusing and framing of the camera, it was not difficult for Nicole to take the proper pictures.
Don't get in front of them,
Dr. Takagishi warned her. He didn't need to worry. Nicole had not forgotten what they had done to that mound of metal.
Your pictures are really very good,
Francesca's voice boomed on the rover receiver.
Nicole, try to speed up to the lead biot, and then fall back little by little, letting the camera pan across each of the ranks.
She waited while Nicole moved to the front of the biots.
Wow, that's superb!
Now I know why we brought an Olympic champion with us.
On his first two attempts, Janos missed with the snare. However, on the third try, it landed perfectly on the number four crab's back. The edges of the net or basket spread out to the limit of the shell. Nicole was starting to sweat. She had been running already for 4 minutes.
From now on, Francesca said to her from the helicopter, focus on a single target crab. Move up as close as you dare.
Nicole reduced her distance from the closest biot to about a meter. She nearly slipped once, and a cold chill swept over her. If I were to fall across their path, she thought, they'd make mincemeat out of me. Her camera was fixed on the right rear crab as Janos tightened the cables.
No!
He shouted. The snare, with the biot entrapped, began to rise off the ground. Everything happened very fast. The target biot used its scissor-like claws to snap through one of the metal threads of the snare. The other five biots came to a brief halt for maybe one full second, and then, immediately, all attacked the snare with their claws. The metal net was completely shredded, and the biot was freed in 5 seconds. Nicole was amazed by what she was seeing. Despite her pounding heart, she continued to film. The lead biot now sat down on the ground. The other five surrounded it in an extremely tight circle. Each of the biots attached one claw to the crab in the center and the other to its neighbor on the right. The formation was finished in less than 5 more seconds. The biots were locked and motionless. Francesca was the first to speak.
Absolutely incredible, she screamed in elation. We just made the hair stand up on every human being on Earth.
Nicole felt Richard Wakefield beside her.
Are you all right? He asked.
I think so, she said.
She was still shaking. The two of them glanced over at the biots. There was no movement.
They're in a huddle, Reggie Wilson said from the rover. The score is now biots 7, humans 0.
Since you are so convinced that there is no danger, I'll agree to go ahead. But I must confess that I myself am nervous about another attempt. Those things clearly communicate with each other, and I don't think they want to be captured.
Otto, Otto, Dr. Brown replied. This procedure is only a straightforward refinement of what we tried the first time. The line nexus will adhere to the shell of the crab and will wrap its thin cables tightly around the entire carapace. The other biots will not be able to use their claws. There will be no room between the line and the shell.
Admiral Heilman, this is Dr. Takagishi.
There was definite concern in his voice as he spoke into the communicator.
I must register my strongest objection to proceeding with this hunt. We have seen already how a little we understand about these creatures. As Wakefield said, our attempt to snare one of them has obviously triggered their main fault protection responses. We have no idea at all how they will react next.
We all understand that, Dr. Takagishi, David Brown interjected before Heilman could respond. But there are extenuating factors that override the uncertainties.
First, as Francesca pointed out, the entire Earth will again be watching if we go after the biots right away.
You heard what Jean-Claude Rivois said 20 minutes ago. We have already done more for space exploration than anyone since the original Soviet and American cosmonauts back in the 20th century.
Second, we are prepared to complete the hunt now.
If we abandon the attempt and return all our equipment to Beta, then we will have wasted a huge amount of time and effort.
Finally, there is no obvious danger. Why do you insist on making such dire predictions? All we saw the biots do was engage in some kind of self-defense activity.
Professor Brown,
the eminent Japanese scholar tried one last rational appeal.
Please, look around you. Try to imagine the capabilities of the creatures who made this amazing vehicle. Try to appreciate the possibility that perhaps, just perhaps, what we are trying to do might be viewed as a hostile act, and has somehow been communicated to whatever intelligence is managing this spacecraft. Suppose, as a result, that we, as representatives of the human species, are condemning not only ourselves, but also, in some larger sense, all of our fellow...
Poppycock, David Brown scoffed. How can anyone ever accuse me of wild speculation?
He laughed heartily.
This is absurd! The evidence overwhelmingly indicates that this Rama has the same purpose and function as its predecessor, and is completely oblivious to our existence. Just because one single subfamily of robots bands together when threatened does not have overwhelming significance.
He looked around at the others.
I say, that's enough talk, Otto. Unless you object, we're going out to capture Bayat.
There was a short hesitation from across the cylindrical sea. Then the cosmonauts heard Admiral Heilmann's affirmative reply.
Go ahead, David. But don't take any unnecessary chances.
Do you think we're really in danger?
Hiro Yamanaka asked Dr. Takagishi, while the new capture tactics were being reviewed by Brown, Tabori, and Wakefield. The Japanese pilot was staring off in the distance at the massive structures in the southern bowl, thinking perhaps for the first time of the vulnerability of their position.
Probably not,
his countryman replied.
But it's insane to take such...
Insane is a perfect word for it, Reggie Wilson interrupted. You and I were the only two vocal opponents of continuing this stupidity, but our objections were made to sound foolish and even cowardly. Personally, I wish one of those goddamn things would challenge the esteemed Dr. Brown to a duel. Or better still, a bolt of lightning would come shooting out of one of those spires over there.
He pointed at the great horns that Yamanaka had been regarding earlier. Wilson's voice changed, and there was a fearful edge to it.
We are over our heads here. I can feel it in the air. We are being warned of danger by powers that none of us can begin to understand. But we are ignoring the warnings.
Nicole turned away from her colleagues and glanced at the lively planning meeting taking place 15 meters away from her. Engineers Wakefield and Tabori were definitely enjoying the challenge of outwitting the biots. Nicole wondered if perhaps Rama really was sending them some kind of warning. Poppycock, she said to herself, repeating David Brown's expression. She shuddered involuntarily as she recalled the several seconds when the crab biots had devastated the metal snare. I'm overreacting. And so is Wilson. There's no reason to be afraid. Yet, as she turned again and looked through the binoculars to study the biot formation half a kilometer away, there was a palpable fear in her that would not be assuaged. The six crabs had not moved in almost 2 hours. They were still locked in their original arrangement. What are you really all about, Rama? Nicole asked herself for the umpteenth time. Her next question startled her. She had never verbalized it before. And how many of us will make it back to Earth to tell your tale? For the second capture attempt, Francesca wanted to be on the ground beside the biots. As before, Turgenev and Tabori were up in the prime helicopter, along with the most important equipment. Brown, Yamanaka, and Wakefield were in the other helicopter. Dr. Brown had invited Wakefield to provide him with real-time advice. Francesca had, of course, persuaded Richard to take some aerial pictures for her to complement the automatic images from the helicopter system. Reggie Wilson drove the ground-based cosmonauts to the biot site in the rover.
"Now here's a good job for me,"
he said as they approached the location of the alien crabs.
"Chauffeur."
He gazed up at the distant ceiling of Rama.
"You hear that, you guys? I'm versatile. I can do many things."
He looked over at Francesca beside him in the front seat.
"By the way, Mrs. Sabatini, are you planning to thank Nicole for her spectacular work? It was her action shots on the ground that captured the audience in your last transmission."
Francesca was busy checking all her video equipment, and at first ignored Reggie's comment. When he repeated his jibe, she responded without looking up.
"May I remind Mr. Wilson that I do not need his unsolicited advice on how to conduct my business?"
"There was a time," Reggie mused out loud, shaking his head, "when things were very different."
He glanced at Francesca. There was no indication that she was even listening.
"Back when I still believed in love," he said in a louder voice. "Before I knew about betrayal, or ambition, and its selfishness."
He jerked the rover wheel vigorously to the left and brought it to a stop about 40 meters west of the biots. Francesca jumped out without a word. Within 3 seconds, she was chattering to David Brown and Richard Wakefield on the radio about the video coverage of the capture. The ever-polite Dr. Takagishi thanked Reggie Wilson for driving the rover.
"We're coming in,"
Tabori shouted from above. He managed to position the dangling Nexus properly on his second attempt. The Nexus was a round, heavy sphere, about 20 centimeters in diameter, with a dozen small holes or indentations on its surface. It was slowly dropped onto the center of the shell of one of the outside biots. Next, Janos, transmitting a barrage of commands from the hovering helicopter to the processor in the Nexus, ordered the extension of the massed threads of metal rolled up inside the sphere.
The crab did not stir as the threads wrapped themselves around the target biot.
"What do you think, Inspector?"
Janos hollered at Richard Wakefield in the other helicopter. Richard surveyed the strange apparatus. The thick cable was attached to a ring stanchion at the rear of the helicopter. 15 meters below, the metal ball sat on the back of the target biot, thin filaments extending from inside the ball around the top and bottom of the carapace.
"Looks fine," Richard replied. "Now there's only the single question remaining. Is the helicopter stronger than their collective grip?"
David Brown commanded Irina Turgenev to lift the prey. She slowly increased the speed of the blades and tried to ascend. The tiny slack in the cable disappeared, but the biots barely moved.
"They're either very heavy or they're holding onto the ground somehow," Richard said. "Hit them with a sharp burst."
The sudden jolt in the cable lifted the entire biot formation momentarily skyward. The helicopter strained as the biot mass dangled 2 or 3 meters off the ground. The two crabs not attached to the target biot dropped first, falling into a motionless heap seconds after takeoff. The other three crabs lasted longer, 10 seconds altogether, before they finally disengaged their claws from their companion and fell to the ground below. There were universal cries of joy and congratulations as the helicopter climbed higher into the sky. Francesca was filming the capture sequence from a distance of about 10 meters. After the last three biots, including the leader, had released their grips on the target crab and fallen onto the Raman soil, she leaned back to record the helicopter.